Harleysville and vacuum tubes with Jeff Harvey and S. Ramanujan.
My best paper, yes, right. The best paper I'll ever write. Yeah, so so I'm going to talk about a paper we recently put on the archive with Nathan Benjamin, Miranda Cheng, Shamit Katru, and Natalie Paquette. And it's closely related to some papers by Christoph Keller and a paper from the summer by Tom Hartman, Christoph Keller, and Bogdan Stoica. In fact, the project began for me when Shamit showed up in Aspen waving that paper in my face and saying, well, let's do something like this for the elliptic genus. And so Shamit asked me a question, and that's going to be the guiding question for this talk. So the question is, how many CFTs have a holographic dual? Okay, so, well, that's kind of a problematic question. We need to préciser, as they say en français, and so let's narrow it a bit. So let's consider families of n equals 2 supersymmetric two-dimensional CFTs, and let's denote them by CM, where M is an integer that's going to go to infinity, and let's assume that these families, this collection of CFTs, have a large M limit. Again, how many have a weakly coupled Einstein gravity duals? Well, it's still a pretty problematic question, and a lot of things need to be defined here. Now, the M here, that's the easiest thing to define. The M is going to be the central charge over 6. That turns out to be more useful for us. I'll always assume it's an integer, and I'll often refer to it as the index. It's just more useful than the central charge. Now, some of the more problematic things are, what does it mean to have a weakly coupled holographic dual? Well, that I'm not going to explain. We'll see in an operational sense what I mean by a large M limit. And one of the really problematic parts of this question is how many? What does that mean? So we're going to need to talk about some kind of measure, and that measure will come from the Zamolodchikov metric. And then we're going to try and answer this kind of question, we're going to need to put some physical criterion, and that's going to be that there's a signal in the partition functions of these theories for a Hawking page of phase transition between the ADS vacuum and black holes dominating the thermodynamics as the temperature is increased. Okay, so then with such a measure, if we have a measure, we have a criterion, then we could ask, well, what's the probability measure of the theories that satisfy our criterion? So that's the strategy. Okay, so now we've had some nice talks from Katrine and Miranda about the elliptic genus, but still, just to establish my notation, I want to say a few words about the elliptic genus. Yeah.
It seems that if it has an Einstein gravity dual, you would expect there to be a Hawking page phase transition. But if there's a Hawking page phase transition, you wouldn't necessarily include it as a gravity dual.
Very good. Yeah, I forgot to say something here. So you see, what kind of outcomes could could come out of such a strategy. Well, we might find that the sequence of theories, that the measure for such sequences of theories as a finite measure, that doesn't mean there's a holographic dual. It just means it passes whatever test we put on it. And you might put another test and another test and another test. Unless you actually construct the holographic dual, I don't see how this strategy can show that there is one. On the other hand, you could also, another possible outcome is you might find it's measure zero, and theories with holographic duals are very rare. So we don't know. Okay, well, we're trying to find out. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Okay, so elliptic genus. Well, as I said, we've had a lot of talks about this. So for me, I'm going to start by thinking of the elliptic genus directly in conformal field theory terms as a trace in the Ramon-Ramon sector. We have n equals 2 supersymmetry. So then we have the right movers. And then we have minus 1 to the f, like that. And I think, as everyone knows, the right movers don't contribute. So this thing is holomorphic. I'll assume there are integral U1 charges. So this guy has a Fourier expansion in terms of some coefficients that depend on the conformal field theory C of q to the n, y to the l. And then we know a few things about this trace physically. Spectral flow tells us that C of nl is C of n plus ls plus ms squared l plus 2ms for all s in the integers. And so that means that the Fourier coefficients are all the same along a parabola of fixed discriminant. So this is the definition of the discriminant. And then we know unitarity. So unitarity says that C of nL is 0 if n is less than 0, and it's also 0 if d is greater than m squared. And then finally, we have the modular property. So E of gamma dot tau z is e to the 2 pi I m cz over c tau plus d e of tau z. In particular, if you take gamma equals minus 1, you learn that c of nl is c of n minus l. Okay, so we have an action on the on this n and l space of the integers this way and z2 this way. And so together, they make a group action, which I'll call the binary spectral flow group. So now you can write a fundamental domain for the binary spectral flow group in the ln plane. Yes, question?
All states on the parabola don't need to have the same zero, because there can be still a Z2 and no.
You're thinking, what you're thinking is that you can write this as C of RD, probably.
Yeah.
No, but it's still true that this formula up here is a true formula.
No, that's another formula.
Oh, I see. So you could have different different L mod 2M sitting on the same parabola. I agree with that, yes. Yeah, I probably misspoke. So so we can make a fundamental domain for binary spectral flow by putting L between 0 and 2M. And now unitarity says that we have to be at positive N. And we also have to be inside this parabola, including that parabola, d equals m squared. Now, as I think everybody here knows, you could take that elliptic genus because of spectral flow. You could write it as an inner product of weight minus a half forms dotted into theta functions. You could give those a kind of, you can write an Rademacher expansion or a Poincaré series or a fairy tale series, whatever you want to call it. And everything is determined, the entire elliptic genus is determined by the polar coefficients. So the polar coefficients is the set of N and L such that 1 is less than or equal to L, is less than or equal to M, N is greater than or equal to 0, and D is positive and less than or equal to M squared. So that's this region here does not include that, and it's here. So if you know the Fourier coefficients in those in that region, in the polar region, then you know the whole elliptic genus. And there are approximately m squared over 12 lattice points in that region. Now, we're going to actually be particularly interested in this Fourier coefficient of the largest polarity. So I'll call that the extreme polar coefficient, C of 0m, my conformal field theory. And if I take the absolute value of that, that's an invariant of my conformal field theory, which I'll write E of C. That's my attempt at a Gothic E. Okay, so all right. So now let's come to part three of the talk, the measure on the space of CFTs. All right, so we're looking at 2-2 theories, so they have moduli. And so we could talk about the space of 2-2 theories. And, well, what distinguishes, we could take that space and write it in terms of connected components. And certainly one thing we can do is talk about the central charge of the index. So we can talk about the theories at a fixed C, but then they're still going to be connected components, and we don't know too much about them, so I'll just write that as a decomposition of the moduli space of theories into the connected components. Now, thanks to Zamolodchikov, we also know there's a metric on this moduli space, the tangent space at a conformal field theory is isomorphic to the set of 1-1 exactly marginal operators. And so if a tangent vector VE corresponds to a 1-1 exactly marginal field phi, then Zamolodchikov defined a metric whose value is phi of 0, phi of 1. Okay? Okay, now, some time ago, Jim Horn and I were thinking about string compactifications. And based on some examples and some wishful physical thinking, we suggested that the M alpha of C would have finite volume in the Zamolodchikov metric. So we were thinking of, you know, a Calabi-Yau compactification. You would have some non-perturbative superpotential. You would have basins of attraction, and we wanted to know what's the probability that you might fall into these different basins of attraction. That was called pre-landscape. Then along came the landscape, and Mike Douglas gave further physical reasons why you might wish these volumes to be finite. And in fact, this is a theorem that it's finite by Liu and Sun, that it's the Vey-Petersen volume of the complex structure moduli spaces of Calabi-Yau's is indeed finite. So by mirror symmetry, the entire moduli space is finite. And I'm going to go a little further. Again, the same kind of physical reasoning slash wishful thinking suggests that even the sum of all the volumes at a fixed central charge is finite. I should say that Andrei Todorov also made this claim. All right, so if we have that finiteness of the volume, well, then measures, you see, push forward. So any kind of invariant you associate with a conformal field theory, you now get a measure on that. So in particular, this absolute value of the extreme polar coefficient is a non-negative integer. So you get a measure on the non-negative integers. So let's just write it. So mu of Gothic E is the volume of the set of conformal field theories such that Gothic E of C is E divided by this V of C. All right, so now the extreme polar coefficient has a very nice property here. It's multiplicative. So if I take a product of conformal field theories, then the extreme polar coefficient of the product is the product of the extreme polar coefficient. Now, we'd also like this to be true for the volume. Okay, so the volume of a product of CFTs is the product of the volumes. Now that gets a big Bourbaki sign, because that's not always true. I mean, that's obviously false if you think about, say, toroidal compactifications. However, it's okay for generic Calabi-Yau's and hyperkalers, simply connected hyperkaler manifolds. And one way to see that is that the relevant Hodge numbers are additive under product. So when we have an ensemble of conformal field theories of this type, I'll call it a multiplicative ensemble. Okay, so in this case, you can be a little more concrete about what this probability measure is. So let's define a conformal field theory is to be prime if it's not a product of two unitary n equals two CFTs with positive index. Okay, so now let's imagine that if we have a multiplicative ensemble that we can enumerate the primes. So let's that was stupid. This alpha is different from that alpha. Let me see if I can do that in real time. A letter A. I think A is pretty neutral. A goes from 1 up to F sub M. That enumerates the distinct primes. So then we can make a generating function because we have a multiplicative ensemble. F sub m might be infinite as long as the product here converges. I don't care. So let's let V of MA be the volume of the moduli space for this prime CFT. And let's let E of MA be the extreme polar coefficient. So we put that to the minus S power. You'll see why in a moment. S is a non-negative real number, let's say. And so now we can expand that, say, from M. M is to be thought of as the total index of the product CFT of C of SM Q to the M. And what is this Xi? It's just a matter of working out the definition. So the Xi is the sum over E equals 1 to infinity of this relative, this conditional volume, over E to the S. It's sort of a zeta function type thing. All right, so,
right?
Yeah.
So this excludes, for example, Gettner models, Calabi-Yau's or Gettner models? I mean, Gettner models would not be prime because they're products of n equals two minimal models, which have a positive.
Wait a second, don't you need to take a quotient there?
Yeah.
That quotient.
You have to take quotient.
No, that quotient's important.
Exactly what do you mean by C1 times C2? Do you mean literally?
I mean literally. No, it's important that you are not taking a finite quotient of those. You'll see that distinction is really important because I'm going to make a big song and dance about the difference between a product and a symmetric product, for example.
Okay.
All right, so once you have this zeta function type thing, then you can get the relative volume, right? So mu of E is then volume of EM over volume of M. And notice, by the way, that the volume of M is actually the value of this psi function at S equals 0. So the psi function is a good thing. It encodes a lot of useful information. Righto. So this is still pretty abstract. So I want to narrow things down some more, and I'll define what I call the K3 ensemble. This is an ensemble of, in fact, 4, 4 theories. And so it's going to be the set of CFTs where I take the N1 powers of the K3 sigma model, N2 powers of the second symmetric power, and so on, the finite product. So then the primes in this ensemble are just the symmetric powers of K3. All right, so now what can we say about these moduli spaces and their volumes in this case? Right, so M1 is a very famous thing. That's a double coset of 0420 mod 04 times 020 modulo the integral automorphisms of the even unimodular lattice of signature 420. So what about n bigger than 1? Well, that was discussed nicely in some papers by Robert Dykroff and Zyberg and Witten. And it's this space, double coset, divided by O gamma prime. I'll say what gamma prime is in a moment. And so this space has 80 real dimensions. This is 84. The reason this is bigger is that if you think in terms of the symmetric product orbifold, you know, when two points collide, you get a locus of A1 singularities, and there's a hyperkala resolution of that locus of A1 singularity, so that's the extra 4. If you look at the other conjugacy classes of the symmetric group, those twist fields can't be exactly marginal. So that's why you get a story like this. The gamma prime follows nicely, as is explained by Dykroff and Zyberg and Witten, from thinking about this from a space-time point of view, where you have a 2B compactification with a 521 moduli space. And so you've got some vector of black hole charges in 2521 with u squared equals 2n. That's because it's measuring d1, d5 charge. And so then the gamma prime is just the isotropy group of this u sitting inside O of 521. Okay. Now, what about the volumes? Well, so this guy, let's see. All right, so let me try and squeeze in the volumes over here, at least schematically. So let's let Vn be the volume. For n equals 1, I'll just call it V, and I hope if time permits, I'll say some more about what V might be at the end. What I want to stress right now is that even though all these spaces are the same as manifolds for n bigger than 1, they don't all have the same volume in the Zamolodchikov metric. They go like n to the dw for n bigger than 1, where d is half the dimension of m sub n, which is, 42? And w is another positive constant. Now, why this n to the d? Well, that's kind of interesting. If O is a exactly marginal operator in the K3 sigma model, then in the symmetric product, it's promoted to this operator with exactly that normalization. So that means the Zamolodchikov metric is scales by a factor of n. And so that means the volume grows this way. And what about the extreme polar coefficient? Well, I'll show you a formula in a moment which makes it obvious that the extreme polar coefficient of the nth symmetric power of K3 is n plus 1. So now with all of that, you can plug that in. You see there's only one prime, so this product goes away up to these constants V and W. You know what this is. I just told you what that is, so this is something you can put on Mathematica. All right, so now we more or less have our measure. So let's find an eraser. Ah, thank you. So now let's go to our physical bound. Maybe I'll keep this up. All right, so the physical bound, as I said before, is that we're going to look at some partition function and ask that it has a first order phase transition indicating that there's a Hawking-Page phase transition. Let me put some formulas on those words. So there's some partition function. I'll be more precise in a moment. Beta is an inverse temperature. It's a positive real number. We have a sequence of conformal field theories. And so we'll take log of this 1 over m. And then we'll certainly ask that the limit exists. That's part of what I meant for mathematicians. You know, I said there exists a good large m limit. So that means many things, but among them, it means that this limit exists. So this is some function f of beta. And we want this function f of beta as a function of beta to look something like this. And as it turns out, at beta equals 2 pi, there'll be some discontinuity in the derivative. Actually, we'd like a little more. We'd like to say something about large m asymptotics. So we'd like the log to be asymptotic as m goes to infinity to m f of beta plus order log m. That's a stronger statement because you could have functions that grow faster than log m but still get killed in this limit. But for physical reasons, I believe we want a log m here. All right, so in the context of ADS3 holography, in the fairy tale paper I wrote with Dijkgraaf, Meldacena, and Frölunda, we had something to say about this. And so we looked at the following. We did a spectral flow to the Nevo-Schwartz sector and defined this object here. And we claimed, well, we had a particular family of CFTs in mind, namely this symmetric products of K3s. And we claimed, stress on the word claim, that we have beta over 4 here for beta greater than or equal to 2 pi. That's the dominance of the vacuum, the ADS vacuum at low temperatures, and pi squared over beta for beta less than or equal to 2 pi. Now, when I write this formula here, I have in mind implicitly that tau is I beta over 2 pi. So tau is pure imaginary. And then you could try and extend this to the tau in the upper half plane. And so we claimed, well, there are a few problems with our discussion. So one thing is we said, well, OK, you can extend this to tau in the upper half plane. And you get an SL2Z invariant phase diagram. And Miranda pointed out to me that's stupid. Because, well, look, I mean, this is actually just gamma naught 2 invariant. Wouldn't it be amazing if you got an SL2Z invariant phase diagram? You don't. Our argument was this. We used this kind of Poincaré series type expansion for the elliptic genus. So we have a sum over polar terms, some kind of rescaled version of the polar degeneracies, and e to the 2 pi I n times gamma dot tau plus L tau over 2 over C tau plus D minus M C tau over 2 squared over C tau plus D. OK. And what we did, what we actually did was for a fixed tau, do a saddle point analysis on C and D. Okay, and we found that for each region in the key, for each fundamental domain in the usual tessellation of the upper half plane, starting with the keyhole region, there's exactly one C and D. And then we made the classic mistake that even though you found a saddle point, you better check that the coefficient isn't zero. So the coefficient is zero sometimes, and it's zero in just such a way that in fact, the phase diagram is gamma naught 2 invariant phase diagram.
continue?
Yeah.
The argument in gravity, the black hole is in the RR sector.
Mm-hmm.
So why are we discussing phase transition?
Well, you know, those distinctions are not so clear. I actually did the spectral flow here to make the Nevot-Schwarz vacuum clearer. But we should still see, I mean, these functions are the same, right, up to some overall powers. So we should still see the BTZ dominance. So I don't think it's that clear that you shouldn't see the, in fact, you do see the BTZ dominance at low temperature, at, excuse me, high temperatures, low beta.
Because, yeah, modular invariance.
Pardon?
Modular invariance is very generic in this kind of function. So.
Yeah.
So that's why I would expect you to see the BTC, but okay.
Well, I mean, you know, you do the naive thermodynamics. You take the usual formulas for the entropy of a spinning black hole and do a saddle point analysis. You look at the saddle point here, and it gives you the same answer. And you say, oh, as you know, the terms here, which are not C equals 1, D equals 0, all having the interpretation of a Euclidean BTZ black hole contribution to the partition function. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do much better than that. Anyway, I still want to trash my old paper. So, yeah.
So this is the old paper.
I'm still talking about the old paper. Yeah, I'm about to trash it. Yeah. Right. So, see, what we didn't discuss was, well, you see, this depends on the conformal field theory. And you said you could have said, well, what if these things? Now, this is a sum over m squared over 12 terms. This is an absolutely convergent series. But you could worry that the growth of these polar coefficients is such as to invalidate that saddle point analysis. And after all, we're interested in the large m limit. And indeed, this ought to fail for product theories, not symmetric product theories. So that's where the papers of Keller et al. Come in. And they were looking at a different set, mostly, of partition functions. But they very significantly turned it around and said, look, let's ask that a limit like this, having a first-order phase transition, let's put that as a criterion on families of CFT in order for there to exist a holographic dual. So, you know, in the old paper, we were thinking about this particular family of CFTs, and there was no doubt, because of the string theory construction, there was a holographic dual. But you could say, well, let's just use this as a tool to see if a family of CFTs could have a holographic dual. Okay, and so then that's where where our project started after their work. We said, well, let's go back and they were looking at other partition functions. Let's go back and look at the elliptic genus. And so indeed, we redo that section of the old DMMV paper in Appendix A. I hope we did it right, finally. But it's technically rather heavy. And I don't want to do it on the blackboard. But fortunately, there's a poor man's version, which I can explain on the blackboard, which gives the right answer. Okay. What's the poor man's version? Well, if I look at this NSR partition function, it's a sum over N and L of C of N, L, conformal field theory, of Q to the M over 4 plus N plus L. OK, so the N equals L equals 0 term gives us exactly the behavior we want, because Q is e to the minus beta when tau is I beta over 2 pi. All right, so that means that all the other terms had better not spoil that behavior. It's as simple as that. So we want C of N, L, and C to absolute value, e to the minus beta, m over 4 plus n plus l over 2. L over 2 because of z is tau over 2. That's important. L over 2 should be less than or equal to e to the m over 4 plus order log m. And if you saturate that inequality, you'd better only saturate it for a number of terms that it grows at most polynomially on M. So that's what this notation means. It means that if you saturate that inequality, you'd better, it's only saturated for a number of terms which grows polynomially with M. So let's do some trivial algebra with this expression. Okay, so just, you know, bring this exponential to the other side. So that means that C of NL is less than or equal to, for at most a polynomial number of terms, e to the plus beta m over 2 plus n plus l over 2 plus order log m. All right, this thing turns out to be positive. So, and I forgot to say something extremely important. We only want this to be true. So this is the black hole. This is the ADS dominance. We only want this to be true for all beta greater than or equal to 2 pi. Otherwise, there's a different dependence, not a q to the m over 4. Right, so now let's, yep. Wait. There's a beta. No? Yes, there's a beta. Yes, thank you.
But then is it beta m over 4, beta m over 4? Oh, yeah.
No, now it's right. Thank you. So now it's beta m over 2. Okay, that's true for all beta greater than or equal to 2 pi. So we can get the best bound by just going down to 2 pi. Can't go further because of the phase transition. Now, there's something funny about this formula. This is spectral flow invariant, binary spectral flow invariant, and this is not. Okay, so we get the best bound by minimizing on a binary spectral flow orbit. So minimize on a binary spectral flow orbit. Okay, and that's an easy exercise. And what you get is you got 2 pi m over 2 plus n naught minus l naught over 2, where n naught and l naught is in the fundamental domain, which I unfortunately erased. There. Okay. Now you could, this might address your question. You could go to the beta, to the high temperature regime, beta less than or equal to 2 pi, work in the Ramon sector, and then ask for dominance of BTZ black holes. The argument is much more involved, but the outcome is the same. So I decided to take the poor man's view, and I've also run out of chalk. Let's see. Here we go. Okay, so you get the same answer, exactly the same answer, if you ask for dominance of BTZ black holes at high temperature. So that's our bound. That's our physical bound. Okay, now this applies to all Fourier coefficients, but let's apply it in particular to the extremal polar term. So that is... need this anymore. That is the case with n naught equals 0 and l naught equals m. And so this is 0. These cancel. That's why those factors of 2 are really important. And so that means that the extremal polar term can only grow polynomially with m. That's our criterion. The extremal polar term can only grow polynomially with m. All right, let's take this for a test run on some examples.
That's a necessary condition.
That is a necessary condition. If our sequence of CFTs fails, we cannot conclude there's a holographic dual. I said it backwards. Excuse me. If that fails, we can conclude that there is no holographic dual. If it succeeds, that's the start of a research project because you now have to ask further questions to see if there is a holographic dual.
Basically, you would have to check this on all the pivot attempts or on all the.
Well, indeed, we can refine this, right? This is supposed to be true for every N and L. It's most effective for the polar terms. Okay, now once you've checked it for the polar terms, maybe you can show by Poincaré series that it's also true for the higher ones. I think actually that might even follow from Christoph's work. I don't know, but
somehow it should be enough to check it on the polar terms because that fixes everything.
That would be a theorem. I mean, that would be maybe I can't do that in real time right here, but that might be a theorem, right? That if it's true for the polar terms, then it's true for the higher coefficients. By the Rademacher type formulas, you could imagine trying to check that or prove that theorem. But that would be a theorem.
But can you check it on your one specific polar term?
Well, we're going to find, as you'll see now, right now, when I do some examples, that this is a pretty effective criterion. You might have to go to some nearly extremal polar terms, right? If L naught is not m but m minus 1, it's still got to grow logarithmically. Okay. Right. So if I put L naught equals m minus 1, I'm going to do that in a moment, and n naught is 0, right? You see the m's cancel. This is just some number. Okay. So it's also a condition on the extremal polar terms. You might need to go there. You might need to go to the whole polar region. I don't know. That depends on your examples. So I'm going to look at some very, very trivial examples where this or the next extremal term is all I need. But since I misspoke earlier, let me emphasize once again that if this criterion fails, then you conclude that there's no holographic dual. So you have a sharp conclusion. If it succeeds, you don't conclude anything. You conclude, well, it passed that test.
So this conclusion is in some measure theoretic sense, or is this?
Well, so far, no. This is just this is a physical bound on families of Jacobi forms, which is a necessary condition for there to exist the holographic dual. I haven't said anything about measures in part 4. Okay. Yeah, I'm assuming 2.2 supersymmetry. It's a good question. I don't know. I mean, we're using nice things about the elliptic genus. Now you might think maybe 2.0 supersymmetry is enough, but but I mean, n equals 1 supersymmetry, I don't know. It's a good question. Now, again, Christoph's work actually doesn't assume any supersymmetry. Okay, so you might be able to play similar games using what he did. He was looking at a different set of partition functions, actually you saw in his talk. He was talking about non-holomorphic partition functions without any word about supersymmetry.
As long as we have n equals 1 on the side which trace over, and we have a global U1, Archer and or not on the side, we don't trace over, we can define the.
Okay, yeah, well. Yeah, so you could get a character. Yeah, I guess you just need n equals 1 on the right to get a Witten index. And yeah. Okay, I haven't thought about other supersymmetries. So let's do some examples just to see how this criterion works. All right, so the first example, let's take our so-called seed conformal field theory C naught, and let's take it to the nth power. And now remember that the extreme polar term is multiplicative. So that's E naught, the extremal polar coefficient of C naught to the nth power. Now, this has index, which is M naught times N, where M naught is the index of C naught. And so this is E naught to the 1 over M naught to the nth power. So if the extremal polar coefficient of the seed is bigger than 1. This is bigger than 1, so this thing is growing exponentially. So this is an example of a sequence of conformal field theories that fails. So as this is, these examples are not meant to be surprising. except possibly for one. So now let's look at a case where it better succeed, which is the symmetric product of a seed, formal field theory, and see what happens there. Okay, so now let's look at symmetric product of the seed CFT. So now we have the symmetric product formula. So the elliptic genus of tau and z and sim n c naught is equal to the product over k greater than 0, n greater than or equal to 0, and l of 1 over 1 minus p to the k, q to the n, y to the l of the Fourier coefficients of the seed CFT, like so. And we want the extremal polar term. So let me assume that the extreme polar term of the seed CFT is positive. So we have to get it by expanding this first term here. Okay, we don't want any powers of q. We want to maximize L, and the index is additive, so it's got to come from here. Okay, which implies that the extremal polar term of the symmetric product is a binomial coefficient.
Why is there no k anymore? Where's the k gone, the product of a k?
Because you want the extremal one. You see, if you take up k, it's very wasteful. You get m's, which are too small, right? Right. We want to get the largest possible m. All right, so you get E of the symmetric product guy is a binomial coefficient, E naught minus 1, E naught minus 1. Okay, so N is the index of the product theory divided by M naught. So this is a polynomial in M of degree E naught minus 1, and so it's okay. Good, we expected that. In particular, E naught of the K3 is 2, and so that gives you the formula I mentioned before, that E of the symmetric power of K3 is n plus 1. So just plug in 2 in here, and you get n plus 1. Indeed, we can use this formula in a handy way to talk about a little bit about permutation orbifolds. Now, that's a huge, huge subject. But one thing you can do very quickly with this formula is just look at symmetric powers of symmetric powers. Okay, so that's like a permutation orbifold by a Riesz product. And in general, that will fail. So let's just look at the nth symmetric power of the nth symmetric power of K3. Okay, so the first one gives us E naught is n plus 1. So we plug that into this formula. And so we get E of this theory is 2n choose n, which is like 2 to the n or something like that, maybe 4 to the n. But what is the index of this theory? It's m squared. So this is going like 4 to the square root of m. OK, so these theories fail. OK, so these don't have holographic duals. Notice, by the way, that it's not, you know, it's sub-exponential behavior, but it's bigger than polynomial. And maybe my last example will be, just to get out of the world of 4-4, let's look at Fermat hypersurfaces. So I guess that's example 4. So let's look at zi to the d plus 2 equals 0 inside cp d plus 1. Let's assume that d is 2m is even, m is integer. OK, so now Katrine wrote these formulas for the elliptic genus in terms of Euler characters. And so a special case of those formulas that she was writing is this nice one. And so now you see, if you look at the extreme polar coefficient, then it's just 2, so we're not going to get anywhere there. But if we look at the next 2 extreme polar coefficient, C of 0, M minus 1, that's interesting. So that's the number of complex structure moduli plus H11. And for this particular example, that's 2D plus 3D plus 2 minus D plus 2 squared plus 1 goes like 2 to the 2D, goes like 2 to the M. Okay, so those fail. So if you take a series of of Calabi hypersurfaces, that won't have a holographic dual. All right, so now we come to the last part of the talk. How am I doing for time? Oh, shoot. Did we start late?
You started 5 past.
Oh, good. Okay. Right. All right. So now I want to return to this K3 ensemble. All right. And I purposely did not erase those blackboards there, so we can still refer to them. And let's think about this Xi function a little bit. And if we think about this Xi function, well, for the K3 ensemble, you see, it follows from the symmetric product formula that, in fact, E for the nth symmetric product is going to begin at M plus 1 and go up to 2 to the M. So for the K3 ensemble, this is going to look like the sum. Give myself some more room. It's going to look like the sum from E is M plus 1 to 2 to the M. This you get directly from the symmetric product formula of the volume of E M divided by E to the S. All right, so now we're really interested in these measures. So let's divide by the volume there. And now you see, we want to take a large M limit. And so this is starting out as M plus 1 to the S. So that's a bit inconvenient. So let's multiply this by M plus 1 to the S. And so we have M plus 1 divided by E to the S. All right. Now, let's consider taking this limit as M goes to infinity. Let's think about that for a little bit. So now, let's assume that this function, which I'll call H1 of S, indeed exists, so that the limit exists. What would we learn from this function? Well, if the function, one thing we know about this H1 of S for sure is that it's equal to 1 at S equals 0. That's just trivial. Now, what if it looks like that? Well, then I would say that there's an appreciable fraction of theories where the extremal polar coefficient grows at most linearly with M. You see, if E is only linear with M, then you're getting some kind of zeta function type story here. And okay, so you're sensitive to the existence of theories. Well, you're saying that there's some non-zero measure on the set of theories where the extreme polar coefficient grows most linearly with M. On the other hand, it might happen that it's 1 here and 0 everywhere else. Well, if that happened, then I would say that at large M, the measure of the space of theories where the extreme polar coefficient grows most linearly with M is 0. Such theories are very, very rare. Well, you know, suppose that happened. Then you would come back to me and you say, oh, yeah, but look, you just said polynomial growth. So, okay, so let's put in HKS, HK. Let's define HK to be M plus 1 to the KS. So let's allow polynomial growth. And then we have the same dichotomy. So if this happens, then we would say that the measure of the space of theories where the E is growing at most order K with M would be zero. Okay, so now, now we got to face up to V and W. Okay, so V and W. So what are V and W? Well, there are these Zamolodchikov volumes of these spaces. So you go to your number theory friends, and they say, oh yeah, Carl Ludwig Siegel calculated that in the 1930s, and you know, here's this paper. So you take the paper, and after a week of trying to figure out what the different capital Gothic letters mean, you realize, God damn it, he put some condition that excludes the actual question you're asking about. And so you go back to your number theory friends and you say, hey, you sent me to this paper and it's clearly sort of the right paper, but it doesn't actually give me the number. I just want a number, for God's sake. And and indeed, that's exactly the problem, because they say, oh yeah, but look, it's just the, you just use the Tamagawa measure on the Adela quotient. I said, yeah, right, thanks. Well, okay, so let me show you the shape of formulas that that Carl Ludwig Siegel gives you. So if V is a quadratic space, meaning a module with a quadratic function on it, then you have a notion. So if this is an integral quadratic form, you have a notion of something called the genus and the class, and I won't define those, but you sum over, there are certain equivalence classes of quadratic forms. You sum over all integral equivalence classes in a, what's called a given genus, and the shape of the formula is that this is a product over all primes of what are called local densities. And what is these alphas? Well, for each prime p, you look at Q, which is a prime power, and there's some kind of counting function. NQ, counting, say, solutions mod Q to some set of quadratic equations. And this is a polynomial in Q. And alpha sub P of QV is like the leading term. So that's the kind of that's the kind of formula that Siegel gives you. Well, okay, so then Peter Sarnock finally gave me a very nice paper by Bielo-Lipetsky. And Gann, called the mass of unimodular lattices. And the frustration doesn't end there, because you know, you get to the final section where they give you the formula and they say, well, the case of even unimodular lattices is so easy, we're not even going to write down the answer. Well, you know, that's probably true if you're an expert in p-adic analysis, in adelic groups. But they do give the answer for the odd unimodular lattices. Okay, so I'm going to proceed by assuming that that answer is in the same ballpark as the even unimodular. I might have to, you know, eat these words. But at least there's a formula I can play with. So to give you a sense of where the, you know, where the kinds of crazy formulas come from that they write, let's just think, let's do something we can do for ourselves. Let's talk about the volume of SOD. In what metric? Well, there, you know, in the Haar metric is unique up to scale. So let's fix that scale by taking a G inverse DG, tensor G inverse DG in the D-dimensional representation. And so then you say, oh ho, this of course is the volume of this quotient times the volume of this quotient times dot, 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 until you get to the volume of the three sphere. Well, that's not quite a sphere. That's a Lens space, so let's divide by SO2. And finally, we get to a volume of a sphere. Okay. And if I did it right, the radius of the sphere is 2. And this is a product of volumes of spheres. And again, if I did it right, who knows, then you get d minus 1, d minus 4 over 2 product from j equals 1 to d of pi to the j over 2 over gamma of j over 2. All right, so so you get these kinds of things like products of gamma functions or products of zeta functions. So let's define VRS to be the volume in a conformal field theory normalization. Now, that was a big pain because B and P normalize their Mahar measure so that the volume of the compact form is 1. So there's a bit of processing that goes in here, and so I could have introduced more mistakes. But this is what I got. And so for R minus S is 0 mod 8, this turns out to be 2 pi to the RS over 2, product from J equals 1 to S, gamma J over 2 over gamma of J plus R over 2 times a function I'll call VG of R plus S over 2, where VG of N is 2 to the N minus 1 plus 1, 2 to the N minus 1, n minus 1 factorial, zeta of n over 2 pi to the n, and then the product from k equals 1 to n of the Bernoulli numbers. Now remember, the Bernoulli numbers start small and get big. So here's the obligatory moonshine for this talk. Here's obligatory moonshine. Okay, so let's plot these volumes. As a function of R, let's plot logarithm of volume of R, R plus 16. And you get a list plot that looks like this. But the scale is such that this is minus 20, and this is 100. And the reasonable values are the ones we happen to be interested in. R equals 4, 5. So, OK. So yeah.
For R equals S equals 2.
Yeah, you could check that. I didn't actually do that. Yeah, because then it just splits. I should have checked that. I didn't. So anyway, I plugging all this stuff in, I got that V is around 10 to the minus 7, and W, well, W, remember, involves this slightly different lattice, but Siegel actually gives you formulas to deal with that. Let me not go into that. All right. I'm no good at Mathematica. So I ran out of computer power at M is around 50, and K is less than or equal to 5. But what appears to be the case is that this is the option. Okay? So the conjecture is that HK of S is chi of S, namely the characteristic function 1 at s equals 0 and 0 s greater than 0. And so I can finish this talk by answering Shami's question, sort of. And the answer, sort of, is subject to all of these things like probable errors, the fact that I'm using the odd unimodular lattice, and so on. But subject to all that, in the K3 ensemble, at large M, theories with holographic duals have measure 0. Thank you.
Smaller than zero, but I mean,
even measures are not negative.
No, I mean, it's even smaller because, I mean, we're counting the whole volume, but probably only a very small part of it because we're doing the elliptic genus, right? So the actual gravity without cancellation. I mean, so without cancellation, that probably touched down even more, is that right?
Okay, I'm not quite sure I understand. Oh, I think I understand. So, you know, maybe what you're saying is this. I just put a condition on the extreme polar term. So that cuts out an ensemble of theories.
Right.
Now, there are more conditions which are independent, like the next two extreme polar term and other things.
And
like,
also like...
And maybe other partition functions.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, I see. So yeah, sure, absolutely. So so it's true that if I'm at large but finite M, I would get some measure here, some positive measure. And it's true that that's an upper bound, because this is just a necessary condition. I totally agree.
I hope my question is a reasonable one. So we put conditions on the polar term.
Yeah.
Let's focus on that now.
Mm-hmm.
For those conditions, is it clear if there's some intersection with as well having a good Rademacher series?
No, I think that's okay. I mean, this is a weight zero weak Jacobi form. There are, you know, you do have to be careful about conversions, but that's been dealt with. And so,
if you find that this conditions are satisfied,
yeah, there's no kind of Rademacher sum ability extra criterion here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jeff, distracted you when you were at the crucial moment of telling us about the obligatory moonshine.
No, this was supposed to be the moonshine. That the values that we're interested in are, I mean, look at these numbers. This is a log scale. So what I'm trying to stress is that these numbers, chalk. Okay, this number is like 10 to the 100 at R equals 11, which is exactly what we're not interested in anymore. So the only, you know, the only numbers which are reasonable are the ones where we have we have space-time dimensions that we care about. On the other hand, well, I mean, I felt this was some obligatory moonshine. This is the best I could do.
We could call it sort of.
I'm sure there are more questions. I have one, but I was going for lunch with this. So let's thank the speaker again.